So there's a lot of places within that recovery value chain that we need to address. In some cases, it is technology. In some cases, we need consumers to be educated on the appropriate behavior to properly segregate their recyclables from trash. And we need to have that collection supply chain incentivized to collect those materials and take them to, you know, a sorting center. Today, many of those pieces are just not working well. And the financial signal from the markets that want recycled content is not making its way through the supply chain. So we sort of have a sense of what's wrong. How we fix it takes time and effort and, you know, good policy. And most importantly, it takes committed communities. It takes communities that want this change. They are at the center of it. All recycling systems are at their, you know, foundation, highly local. So you have to have a community that tells its citizens, this is something we want to have happen. We want your help. And they're willing to be committed to helping, you know, develop that system.
That was a brief from this week's feature segment on what is missing and what it takes to realize the vision of a waste-free world. Stay tuned for the full conversation. Hello and a warm welcome to yet another episode on the Mission Chunya podcast. Wherever you are in the world, I hope you are doing well. The podcast has been attracting a lot of new listeners from around the world every week. If you are one among them, a special welcome to you. At the end of this episode, if you felt the episode added some value to your thoughts, please take some time and write a review or share it in your network so that more people who are interested in this global transition to the net zero carbon economy, discover this show. Now on to this week's feature segment. The recent turn of events in early 2022, especially the war in Europe, has put the focus back on resources and commodities. The issue is both on the availability and the price front. Well, even more importantly, if we look at the bigger picture, we would have to understand that nearly 30% of the annual global emissions comes from manufacturing or producing consumer goods. So, it definitely makes sense to consider recovering resources that we use, because it helps on two fronts. It reduces the dependency on new resources and also prevents dumping of the used resources, which creates pollution of epic proportions. So, how do you create an ecosystem that thrives on reducing waste and recovers a significant portion of valuable resources? Well, our guest for this episode is from an organization that has helped stakeholders do just that for 30 plus years. So, who is our guest for today?
Hi, Gresh. I'm Ann Johnson. I'm a vice president and principal at Resource Recycling Systems. We go by RRS. We are based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but operate globally.
And let's begin by looking at the origin story of RRS. But before that, I think you have had a long career in sustainability. So how did you get interested and what's kept you motivated all through your career so far?
Well, I was very fortunate to be raised in a household with a father who was a scientist. He did a lot of early work on acid rain and, in fact, helped coin the term acid rain.
Nice.
And as a child, I was his field hand. And so learned about science, learned about the environment, and also, you know, was sort of exposed to one of the very early research projects that documented, you know, the impact of human industry on the environment. And so that's sort of the foundation of how I got into sustainability. I was always inclined towards environmental work, and I've just been fortunate to be able to follow that path. I think that the thing that continues to motivate me, I I have degrees in engineering and in science, a background in chemistry. And very early on, I had the opportunity to work with Bill McDonough and Michael Braungart while they were writing the book Cradle to Cradle. So I really was lucky to see firsthand, you know, these ideas around how do we talk about sustainability? What does it really mean? You know, Cradle to Cradle is now really been socialized as the circular economy.
Correct.
But having gotten in on sort of the ground floor was really instrumental in sort of framing how I look at, you know, the world of industry and our presence here on the planet and inspiration for how we might be able to stop or slow, I think, some of the really negative trajectories we see. And I think what continues to inspire me is that, you know, I've been at RS for about 10 years. I think we do very impactful work. It's very operational. But I also recognize that there's a significant need in other parts of the world for, I think, the experience that we have in implementing systems, implementing solutions and interventions that, you know, really can improve our communities, our local environment and social conditions for people.
That's interesting. It's good to know that you were kind of the first observers of the work Cradle to Cradle. So as you rightly said, it's like a big theme now, especially now considering the requirement for resources that we have. So everyone's gone back to that concept and saying like circular economy is the next thing that we have to work. And that perfectly leads me to the story of RRS. You have been with them for 10 years, as you said, but they are in the space for 30 plus years now. So where did they get started? I'm sure when they started, it was not recycling and circular economy was not a big thing, but how did they manage to convince the stakeholders in the process?
So the gentleman who founded RRS is Jim Fry, and he remains our CEO today. So he's been with the company for over 35 years. And I think, you know, the origin story is, I think, you know, Jim was really interested in how do we establish community-based recycling programs and what does that take? So he was very much in the ground floor of that in the US. And in fact, you know, was responsible for helping to start one of the very first curbside recycling programs in the United States. And I think through experience, you understand that, you know, there are a number of elements that impact a successful recycling system. You have to have infrastructure to collect, infrastructure to segregate and sort materials, and you have to have markets that want to purchase those materials. That's sort of the infrastructure side. But at the same time, you need to educate people how to use those systems. We're not born knowing how to manage waste or how to recycle.
Correct.
That's something that we have to educate people on. And then policy has a role, as well as how do we fund these systems? So, you know, I think working with municipalities was really where he started. And I think at that time, 35 years ago, was really where there was a growing environmental awareness of we need to steward our resources better to preserve, you know, our environment and the environment for future generations.
You did mention that he started off working with municipalities. Were they the first clients? And they probably were not ready to pay for the services. So how did you get that thing sorted?
Well, I think the first clients were municipalities. And I think that Jim had the fortune of living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And the area around Ann Arbor, you know, the University of Michigan is there. I think this was the value of recycling was something that was shared by the municipal government and the communities.
Nice.
So these first programs were very much funded by municipalities through, you know, taxes and through citizens paying, you know, disposal fees. So that's really how a lot of these first systems were municipally funded. What we've seen in the US is a lot of privatization.
Correct.
Of elements of the recycling system. And so then you have private money coming into play. But what we're experiencing today is, you know, those communities who value stewardship of their materials and recycling are usually willing to put up some money and pay for it. States also do that. Communities that don't don't have very good systems. And it really is reflected in the quality of the programs. And that's where policy can play a role, because policy can really incentivize, what a community is going to do, set recycling targets, implement funding systems through things like EPR. And we're starting to see that transition in the U.S., and we're certainly seeing that transition in other parts of the globe as well, including India.
Transitioning to this big, wide group, you started off in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then now you grew to a lot of other cities in the U.S., and a lot of stakeholders were onboarded. So how did that diversification happen? You then started offering a range of services as well. Was it organic, or did you see that there was a market demand already there for services that you were offering?
I think in the early days of RS, and of course you can see this was like in the late 80s, early 90s, I think growth was very organic. I think this was still a very new concept, municipal recycling programs. Sort of the start of it in the U.S. was in the 70s. I remember being a kid and segregating, cans and glass bottles and, the things, taking the labels off and all that. But by this point, curbside recycling was becoming more sophisticated, where we had, collection systems that could be multi-bin, or today we have single stream collection where all recyclables go into one bin. But when you do that, it means it has to go to a pretty sophisticated facility that can sort those materials into commodities, whether it's aluminum cans, steel cans, paper, and the different types of plastics. So RRS's growth sort of mirrors that development and sophistication of recycling systems, where we move from, sort of source segregated recycling, meaning you segregate the materials into, individual types, to single stream. And RRS developed capability around MRF operations, around municipal contracting with, MRF operators. How do you work with a hauler and recycler to collect your material? Also worked with end markets to ensure, if we're going to collect this, we got to make sure it's the quality that the end market is looking for, and it's a good fit for those supply chains. So RRS's sort of evolution on the municipal recycling side really mirrored that evolution of recycling. And today we have, very sophisticated experience across, community education, collection systems, operational, how do you route trucks most efficiently, to designing MRFs, re-equipping MRFs, MRF operations, as well as end market development. We do a lot of work on, trying to connect the supply chain of recovered materials to those who want to use them as recycled content.
That's interesting.
I would say more recently, we really diversified. My particular area is really in what I would call sustainable materials management, with the design of products, specifically packaging, and understanding, what is designed for recyclability? How do you know something will fit into the infrastructure that's out there for them? Does it fit with what the reclaimers or the material, recyclers are actually looking for? So I have a very broad background in sustainability, and brought that to RRS to help establish our corporate sustainability practice area, along with my colleague, Susan Graff. So that's for 10 years, RRS has now expanded, outside of this municipal arena into a much broader set of clients that include a lot of individual corporate clients, as well as we do a lot of collaborative work with sort of multiple companies across supply chains, or across supply chains and across communities. So we're quite a diverse organization at this, today, with a real focus on circular economy.
That's very good to know. Particularly, I like the last part around the new thing that you're bringing onto the table, especially looking at corporate sustainability goals. So how does that project cycle happen? So what is the duration of this engagement typically, and how does it actually happen with big brands?
Well, I will say early in my career, which is way back in the 90s, this was new territory for companies. And I had projects, before I was at RS, helping some very large multinational corporations establish their very first sustainability goals. And they were very broad. You know, they were around waste, they were around energy, they were around water, they were around diversity. And it was a very interesting process of working with senior executives to really understand what did this mean in the context of their particular business, because it's different.
Correct.
If you're a brand and you're making consumer-facing products versus you're a commodity manufacturer. So today, you know, if we move forward today, those brands are now in, you know, their fourth or fifth generation of goals. They have a good handle on what sustainability means to them. And they really understand the business advantages, the business risks, and they have pretty much picked the low-hanging fruit. And they are now left with some of the more challenging, you know, objectives, I would say, the goals that they have. And you see things like, you know, how they have goals around plastic in emerging markets, where there are very underdeveloped solid waste and recycling systems. They have been working in these regions and selling their products for many years. And now we are really witnessing the consequence of that collision of modern materials with underdeveloped systems creates some very significant, you know, environmental, community, and social challenges around mismanaged materials. And that is a huge topic for big brands today. And I think there's, you know, we see goals around recycled content, around recyclability, aimed at trying to address those. But those are very challenging goals in some markets. I think that, you know, so those, to get to your question about like, what does a project look like? You know, there's goal setting, and it's different depending on where a company is in its sort of learning curve around sustainability. And, you know, those goals can be very different for people who are just starting versus people who are well on their way. And once those goals are in place, then there's this piece around implementation. And we may or may not help companies do that. I help companies often with implementation, whether it's around zero waste or achieving packaging objectives, ensuring that some examples could be a very short duration project, evaluating packaging for design for recyclability, for instance, and doing assessment of how their particular package might perform in a particular market. Would it in fact be collected for recycling? If it is collected, would it end up in a commodity? And is there somebody to actually recycle it in that market? Or is it likely to be exported to be reprocessed in another market? Or, you know, would it be likely to be exported to a market that actually isn't prepared to manage that material? And you know, we see today the legacy of that kind of behavior from the past decades. And we're really, you know, it's taken a toll on our environment and on communities.
True. Now, you did mention about the corporate goals. In this implementation part of it, looking at the way things have panned out in the last few decades, and from your experience, where do you think the real challenge is? Is it that there is a lack of awareness among the general consumers, the end consumers? Or do you think there is a bit of technology gap that is there in the system, like, say, for example, packaging can't be recycled, or there are no end customers for the recycled products, or there isn't a technology that can do it more efficiently? Is it the supply side or the demand side? Where do you think the biggest challenge is?
Both and all of the above. I think we have a really challenging situation. The demand is there.
Okay.
We know with these corporate goals, there is demand. They are looking for content, but they need content of a specific quality. You have to have food grade quality recyclate to put it into a new bottle or put it into a food package. So quality is a very important thing. Recycling systems, that is, you know, to make the economics work, we have to collect really scaled volumes of material. Not all of it is going to be appropriate to go back into packaging. There has to be a market for some of those lower value materials. And durable goods are often where that material goes. So we have a bit of a disconnect in that these brands have goals, but they're around packaging, and much of that packaging is for food or food contact.
Fair.
And yet we have, and that means you need a pretty sophisticated supply chain that has, and I'm going to go backwards from the demand to supply, You have to have reclaimers who can produce food quality material. That means that policies have to enable food grade material. You have to have sorting systems or collection centers that are segregating materials into appropriate classes of material, including material that's suitable for food grade processing. Now, you know, you have to have solutions for all that material you collect, or the economics don't work out. And then you get down to collection, which is where we have a lot of informal collection. And that collection is really focused on what has the most value, because there's no incentive to, you know, collect low value materials, which is often food packaging. You know, it's a film, it might be a multi-layer. And so that's not something that's typically collected. So there's a lot of places within that recovery value chain that we need to address. In some cases, it is technology. In some cases, we need consumers to be educated on the appropriate behavior to properly segregate their recyclables from trash. And we need to have that collection supply chain incentivized to collect those materials and take them to, you know, a sorting center, whether it's a, you know, a highly automated MRF or whether it's a very manual MRF. Today, many of those pieces are just not working well, and the financial signal from the markets that want recycled content is not making its way through the supply chain. So we sort of have a sense of what's wrong. How we fix it takes time and effort and, you know, good policy. And most importantly, it takes committed communities. It takes communities that want this change. They are at the center of it. All recycling systems are at their, you know, foundation, highly local. So you have to have a community that tells its citizens, this is something we want to have happen. We want your help. And they're willing to be committed to helping, you know, develop that system.
Well, I like this point about community-led engagement. And that goes back to the origins of RRS also. You started with a community-based recycling program. So I'm sure, in spite of being in the industry for 30 plus years, the biggest challenge is getting community involvement right across the spectrum at all levels. So that is the biggest challenge. And as you rightly said, if we probably address that, probably we could tackle the other big challenges also.
Right. And I think this is where, you know, I think brands and retailers are very challenged because, you know, they're really good at making products and selling products. But when it comes to recycling, they and waste management, it's together, they have to engage with communities. And that's not what they're used to doing. They're used to engaging with consumers. And so I think this is where, you know, we've really come to the realization it takes collaboration across a quite a complex supply chain to connect the sort of manufacturing industry part of it with the municipal consumer side of it. And we need that engagement. And activating communities, making them understand, you know, why this is important to them, why it will help them, that there is demand for these materials. We do have solutions. That's a really important conversation that we need to figure out how to better sort of catalyze.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. Because as you rightly said, from the brand's perspective, their end objective is to reach the consumer in whatever form the consumer wants. But when he has to close the loop, then he has to look at the community, in the wider community, to get back.
Absolutely.
So that's really interesting. And yeah, it's something that we should definitely think on. How do we incentivize communities to come forward and engage with the programs and then get to, again, closing the loop back with the producers of and the big brands that produce the content?
I think that that is, you know, communities have, you know, municipal governments have a lot of responsibility and a lot of obligations. And often waste and recycling is very low on their priority list. And, you know, they're working on roads, they're working on, you know, education, they're working on safety, public safety. So this is why a dedicated funding stream for waste and recycling is really critical. And then having municipal, you know, governments have well-trained people that understand these issues and understand, you know, the role it plays in the health of their community. And that is a really important starting part, because municipalities have so many diverse obligations. There needs to be a focal point to really intersect on this waste and recycling issue. And often, you know, this is a matter of public health, environmental health, and community quality. And there's an economic component to it as well. And so I just want to, you know, it's municipalities are generally underfunded and over obligated. And so it's a challenging place to work with, but one we have to tackle. There's just no doubt.
Exactly. I mean, you can just hide the problem from the consumers to a level, but you can't hide it any further when the challenge gets really big. So that's very true. You did mention about plastics, Anne, but there are a lot of other things also that are coming up, especially for RRS. I think organics recovery is also something that you're working on in the recent past. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, you know, organics are represent at a minimum maybe 40% of what's in a municipal solid waste stream. When we think about emerging markets, it's often 50 to 60% of the municipal solid waste stream. So in other words, it is a massive proportion of our waste. It is also a highly reactive portion of our waste. So it converts to methane very rapidly if it's not managed well. And so this really gets down to the foundation of how we think about, you know, sustainable materials management or waste management, is that we really need to prioritize organics, segregate them from recyclables, and segregate them from trash, so that we can treat that part, a very climate intensive portion of our waste stream, and ensure it has a minimum, you know, climate impact. And you know, the preferential path would be that we could either, you know, generate biogas or compost it and create nutrients for the soil. But that can only happen if we segregate our waste appropriately. And I think that as we feel more and more pressure from climate change in our communities, the role of our waste to be nutrients for our future food production, for soil health, is critically important, and also potentially for the generation of renewable energy. So we do a lot of work in this area. We help communities develop systems to segregate food waste. We help companies figure out how to manage food waste. We work on, you know, solutions like digestion or composting. We set up composting programs. We also work on end markets for these materials. So, you know, this is a really important area because it represents such a large portion of waste, and one that has a big climate impact.
True.
And I'll just say that, you know, it's really an important one to manage, because increasingly, you know, we're seeing contaminants show up in some of these organic streams, PFAS being one of them. They're a perfluorinated chemical compound that is what's called a forever chemical, and they can move through the food chain and bioaccumulate. And we need to make sure that these streams are kept safe and healthy for, you know, people and the environment.
Well, that's really interesting. It's good to know that it is also essential that we tackle this problem. Of course, we do hear about methane emissions in the recent past, especially in the last COP. There was a separate discussion and a separate agreement on that. So organics and managing organic waste is also a big part, and glad to see that municipalities are also increasingly aware, and they are also looking at solutions to tackle this big problem.
And I was going to say, there's a lot of interest, but this is where we really need well-educated citizens on the importance of this and the actions they need to take, because communities might want to do these, you know, food waste segregation, but it's up to the consumer to take the right action. And they need to know what to do and where to do it. And, you know, this is not just like one and done education. This is, we have to start in school. We have to create a stewardship culture within our citizenry to make sure that they manage their waste the best as possible.
Perfect. Now, we spoke about what RRS has been doing in the last few decades. And you did mention that during the start of the conversation that your main focus now is emerging markets. So Do you see a lot of potential for RRS in emerging markets? What kind of projects do you engage in the emerging markets at this point?
I think there's immense opportunity in emerging markets, and I also think there's immense need. This is a major focus of my work today, is try to bring the experience of, 35 years of setting up systems, of developing material supply chains, of working with municipalities, working with companies, working with packaging companies, brands and retails, to bring that experience to emerging markets where we really need to start building these systems and start educating consumers on how to use these systems, and also influencing policymakers on what are the supportive policies we need to make these systems effective. And I think, as you know, we are globally in a waste crisis.
Correct.
And it is just projected to get worse by 2050. The World Bank has projected that we will double the amount of waste that's generated, and most of that will occur in emerging markets. And today we have very underdeveloped systems, so we have very large quantities of mismanaged waste that have, significant climate impact and environmental impact from, plastics being released in the environment. So we need to get on these solutions. This is a really important health issue, an important environmental issue, and quality of life issue for our communities. And we know how to do it. It's just we need to start doing it today and getting everybody engaged, kind of rowing in the same direction. And I think we could see, results pretty quickly, because this isn't like we have to figure out how to do it. We know how to do it. We just have to start, putting the right practices into place.
Well, that's a very good point to kind of move to my final question on this, Anne, because you've been in the space for a long time, and we've spoken about this. Communities are a big part of this ecosystem. And when you talk about communities, consumers are an integral part. Now, from your personal experience and from your viewpoint, what do you think is holding back the consumers from being more aware, like, for example, segregation, and knowing more about the ecosystem and how they can contribute? What do you think is holding them back? And what are the possible interventions that you can play to ensure that consumers act more responsibly?
That's a tough question. It has a lot of dimensions to it. And I think, one is, I sort of start off with, how did I get interested? I had a role model and a parent who was very environmentally minded and made sure that as a child, I took the actions I needed to take. Not everybody has that experience. So we need to create the education, in schools and right away on how do we become stewards of our homes, of the waste we produce, of the energy we use. And, so there's a couple of pieces to that. One is the education, but we also then have to have the infrastructure in place for citizens to take that action. So today, we don't really have both of those things all the time. But I think education is a really important place to start. That will create a demand for infrastructure. I think it will also create more willingness to invest in the needed solutions. I think there's a lot of investment sitting out there, but it has to see that commitment from municipalities and, to draw some of that investment. And so it means there also needs to be transparency.
Correct.
If people are going to invest, they have to know their money is used wisely in the what it was intended for. But I think, there's a number of different things. I think we need to talk more about how this is a quality of life issue for us to, we like to keep our homes clean. We like to keep things orderly. That should extend to our communities, that we will benefit, if we have a cleaner environment, if there's more care taken, it will also attract people.
True.
So I think when people are, there are socioeconomic issues that make it more challenging. If people are just, going day to day, they don't have a lot of time either for education or understanding the consequences, because it's, and I think that as we see economic development, I think we will also see some changes in behavior. So it's very complex question that you pose there. But I would start with education, consistent education over time, and investment in infrastructure, and then, you know, bring everyone up, you know, at a certain point. We, in communities where we have seen dedicated investment in education over a long period of time, we see the highest performance in terms of not just recycling, but overall sort of environmental performance, including, you know, climate objectives and things like that. And that's communities that have been doing this for 20 or 30 years. Communities are just starting out. The performance isn't that great, but it improves over time. And you just have to keep at it.
Well, that's really wonderful. That's a wonderful note to kind of end this conversation. And it's good to know that education plays a big role in setting up the community to act more responsibly. And it should probably start right from schools and then the engagement. It takes time, but if consistent education happens at all levels, then probably, as you said, a couple of decades later, probably we'll have better systems in place and hopefully more responsible citizens as well. So, and it was a pleasure having this conversation with you, having someone as experienced as you come on the podcast and share the story of how a organization that started off with community-based recycling program is now a global organization helping a lot of cities globally get better recycling programs. It's a wonderful story and a lot of perspectives from your experience added value to the conversation. So thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Grish. I really appreciate it.
So yes, that was a wrap on yet another insightful conversation. Hope you enjoyed listening to Anne's journey of over 2+ decades in the sustainability transformation space. And more importantly, the story of RRS and how it has transformed into a pioneer when it comes to helping stakeholders, both public and private sector, and help reduce waste and recover valuable resources. The clients they serve range from industries, city councils, big brands, and multinational agencies, in addition to others like universities, etc. Their primary value addition is to define the strategy and lay the groundwork for the systems and processes. You should definitely check their work at recycle.com. Very easy to remember, but I will leave the links in the show notes and also include the links to connect with Anne in the description section. While you are there, you should also check terrageneration.com, our friends who are behind the episode artworks for the show. Terra Generation is a content agency specialized in telling stories in climate, biodiversity, and sustainability. And finally, I will have to thank our earlier guest and a huge supporter of the podcast, Gabriel, for introducing me to Anne and the RRS team. So, well, if you have any guest recommendations or topic suggestions, please feel free to write me an email. missionchunia@gmail.com is the ID. I definitely read every single mail that I receive. You can also write a review on Apple Podcast or any platform that you listen to the show on. I will be back in 2 weeks' time with yet another insightful conversation. So until then, this is Girish Shivakumar signing off. And as always, thank you for listening.